You ever thought about the question, what does it mean to be a Christian? You're here this morning, you testify that you're born again. You testify that you're born from above. You're born of the Holy Spirit, as Jesus says in John 3 and John 3:5. But if you were to take what it means to be a Christian and reduce it down to the most simplest statement, what do you think you would say? Well, there's an old hymn that captures, I think, what it means to be a Christian in the simplest phase. It's, I need no other argument. I need no other plea. It is enough that Jesus died. And it doesn't end there, but it continues, and he died for me. And that's the question. That's what I want you to think about this morning. Can you say those words with complete confidence? Not just that Jesus died, but can you say the words that Jesus died for you? Do you not only know that intellectually, but have you experienced that? Is it an experiential truth for you? Are you walking in the knowledge that your God redeemed you because he loves you, that he redeemed you because of his love? Do you feel that love? Do you experience that love? That's what authentic Christianity is about. It's someone who can say, I need no other argument. It's someone who can say, I need no other plea. It is enough to know that Jesus died, and he died for me. But then as we grow in our understanding of what it means to follow Jesus, of what those words of Christianity in its most simplest basic form mean, we start to fill in that truth, don't we? Right? The Bible's constantly reminding us that we shouldn't be on milk. We need to be on solid food. You know, so we have to dig deeply into the Word of God. You see a little baby on a bottle, it's a beautiful thing. You see a grown man on a bottle of milk, it's kind of weird, right? So we should be digging deep into the riches of God's Word. We should be on solid food. And as we start to get on solid food, those other biblical words come in and they start to fill in deeper understanding. They start to add color and nuance of what it means to be a Christian. You know, the biblical words we use all the time here, words like salvation, atonement, justification, sanctification, propitiation, expiation, words we use frequently here, not because they're abstract theological terms, but because they're words in the Bible. And I am confident that you might struggle giving a definition, but if you were pressed, I'm confident that you could describe what most of those words mean if we're giving them to you in the context of Scripture. So as we grow in our understanding, let's try to keep a balance. We don't want our understanding of the gospel message, we don't want our understanding of the work our God did on the cross on our behalf for us as our substitute to just exist in some scholarly realm. We want to have the intellect, but we want the intellect to drive our passions. We want the intellect to drive our emotions. We want the intellect to drive how we look at our God and how we speak of our God. Because the worst thing we can do is talk about the gospel, talk about the reality that we need no other argument, we need no other plea, that our Savior died and that he died for you and he died for me. We don't ever want to talk about that in a mechanical sense. You know what I mean by mechanical? Have you ever heard someone share the gospel and it sounds like a sales technique? It sounds like a sales presence, the presentation. It turns it into the mechanical realm. That is the sin of the highest degree, to take the gospel, a story of redemption by love, and to turn it into something mechanical. God redeemed us because he loves us. Let me turn that around and say it directly to you. God redeemed you because he loves you. Do you believe that? Do you believe that Christ had you on his mind as he took his death march to Jerusalem, or as Isaiah said, as he set his face like flint to Jerusalem? You can just see the sparks flying. It was because of the depth of his love for you. This is not an abstract, mechanical, or theological system. We don't love Christianity simply because of all of its consistencies, even though it is the only consistent worldview. We don't love Christianity because of the rationalistic deductions we can make. We love Christianity because of a person. Christ died personally for you. A person's life was sacrificed for you. God came all the way from heaven. God the Son took on a real human nature to sacrifice himself, to redeem you, to adopt you, to bring you into his family so you can call his father the same thing he calls his father, Abba, Father, dearest Father. So we love Christianity. We find the beauty of it, not in the system, but the beauty of Christianity in the person. This is not a transactional business transaction that takes place in Christianity. It's personal. It's relational. It's love because of redemption. And that's why I love the story of Ruth so much. Because the story of Ruth is the story of love because of redemption. This is not a man redeeming a woman simply because of the letter of the law. This is a man going beyond the letter of the law all the way to grace because he loves her dearly. And I want to show you that that's a picture of God's love for you. I'm going to give you some text from the Old Testament just to show you, and then we'll move it into the New Testament to show you that God redeems because of his love. And that's what we're going to see unpacked in Ruth chapter 4. But first, let's go to Deuteronomy 4:37, and I'll have this text up here behind me. Deuteronomy 4:37 captures the love of God in this act of redemption. It says, "And because he is God the Father, because he loved your fathers." So God loved the fathers, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, because he loved your fathers and chose their offspring. So that's everyone who becomes part of God's family. God chose them, and love and God's choice are always put together. He chooses because he loves. Let me keep reading. "And because he loved your fathers and chose their offspring after them and brought you out of Egypt with his own presence by his great power." That's God redeeming because of his vast love. Let me give you another one, Deuteronomy 7, 6 through 9. This is going to be kind of hard for you to see, but I wanted it all on one slide. So if you can't quite make that out yet because you don't have new glasses like I do, just listen to me read the words for you. Deuteronomy 7, 6 through 9 reads, "For you are a people holy to the Lord." So you're holy, you're set apart, you're chosen. He's grabbed you and he's put you somewhere separate just for himself. "For you are a people holy to the Lord, your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for his treasured possession." So you hear the affections there. He chose you to treasure you. Think of something you treasure. If it's something that you treasure, it's something that you love deeply and you love dearly. And scripture continues, "Out of all the peoples who were on the face of the earth, it was not because you were more in number than any other people that the Lord set his love on you and chose you, for you were the fewest of all peoples. But it is because the Lord loves you." So why did God choose? "Because the Lord loves you and is keeping the oath that he swore to your fathers, that the Lord has brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of slavery, from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt." Remember, that whole Exodus story is a picture of the gospel. Verse 9, "Now know therefore that the Lord your God is God, the faithful God who keeps covenant and steadfast love with those who love him and keep his commandments to 1,000 generations." It's redemption because of love. God redeems because he loves you. And then when you start to move to the prophets, you hear the exact same thing. Let me read just from the book of Hosea. In Hosea 11:1, we have this text up here for you. You should be able to read this one, big font. "When Israel was a child..." What does it say? "I loved him. I called him out of Egypt. I called him my son." Isn't that beautiful? Let me keep going. Hosea 11, let me read 3 through 4, because sometimes God compares the relationship between himself and his people as a husband and a bride, and sometimes he gets even to a more dear relationship, the relationship between a mother and a child, between a father and a child, between a beloved parent and how they love their children. Listen to Hosea 11, 3 through 4. "Yet it was I who taught Ephraim how to walk." That's an old name for Bethlehem. "I took them up by their arms, but they did not know that I healed them. I led them with cords of kindness, with the bands of love." There you see it again. "And I became to them as one who eases the yokes on their jaws, and I bent down to them and I fed them." It's just because of love, the type of love that a parent loves their very own child with, that God chose to redeem you. When you get to the New Testament, you see the exact same thing, but it becomes fuller. It becomes even more complete because we see this redemption of love even more personal because there's a very personal sacrifice that is made. And 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 18 through 19 says, "Knowing that you were ransomed," that means bought, purchased, redeemed. So you're in slavery to yourself, you're in slavery to your idols, you're in slavery to your world system, you're in slavery to your own desires, you're in slavery to the rat race you're caught up in, you're in slavery to the acceptance of your family, of your peers, of your friends, whatever the things you're in slavery to, Christ bought you, he purchased you, he owned you because he loves you. Let me keep reading. Knowing that you were ransomed from the futile ways inherited from your forefathers, not with perishable things such as silver or gold. Get this. Listen to how personal. But with the precious blood of Christ, like that of a lamb without blemish or spot. So why did he do this? Why did he buy you? Why did he purchase you? Why does he own you? Why has he brought you into his family? Ephesians 5:25 tells us that Christ loved the church and he gave himself up for her. He loved the church. He loved you. That's why he gave his life for you. So here you have Christianity. Here you have the gospel. Here you have the story of redemption, not as some cold theological abstraction, but it's personal. It's relational. It's redemption because of love. And that's exactly what we see in the story of Ruth. Redemption because of love. But the story of Ruth isn't ultimately a story about the love of a man, Boaz, and the love of a woman, Ruth. It's a story whose trajectory goes further. It goes all the way to Jesus Christ, who loved his church. Therefore, he died for his church. That's the beauty of Christianity. So let me catch you up in the story so far, how we got to chapter 4. Let's do it by putting you in the story of Ruth. Because remember, I told you, this is not just a story for you, it's a story about you. So say you're one of the ordinary field workers and you happen to work in Boaz's field. Just happen to, by happenstance or circumstance, right? No, it's by God's providence, his invisible hand that guides every aspect of your life, every decision you've made of your own free will, every decision that's been made for you or towards you or against you. God's providentially leading everything towards its predetermined end. So you just happen to start working for the one guy during the period of Judges who happens to love God, happens to be a wealthy man who loves God and lives righteously and follows him. So you're working in the fields of Boaz, and you love working for Boaz. He's such a righteous man. He has such godly character. He's a man of hesed. Remember that Hebrew term we've been unpacking every week? It's a name for God's steadfast love, his loyal love, his faithful love, his one-way radical covenant-making, covenant-keeping love, the love that brings you into covenant relationship with God. And it just doesn't bring you there. Now you have to fight to stay there. You have to fight to keep God's love because you don't want to lose your salvation. No, it's the love that keeps you there. You can't. You try to run from him, the hound of heaven will always find you. He will always sniff you out. He will always bring you back home. That's the covenant-making, covenant-keeping love. That's hesed. And Boaz is a man of hesed. And you're coming back after a hard day's work, and you love working hard because you love working because God's created you to work and to produce something for the benefit of others and to take care of your friends and to take care of your family and to take care of God's people. And you see two women walking to town. And the whole town is just buzz. It's stirred up. And everyone's saying, is that Naomi? All right, they remember Naomi. She was from a noble family. Her husband, Elimelech, was a very wealthy man. And they had two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. And they all left. And they left to the most odd place. They left God's covenant land. They left God's people, and they went to preserve their life and to preserve their family and to preserve their name and to preserve their finances. They left to the town of Moab, a place they had no business being, and they lost everything. And you just see Naomi coming back by herself. What happened to Elimelech? What happened to Mahlon? What happened to Chilion? You come to find they all died. And that woman who's walking with her is a foreigner. It's a woman from Moab, a nation that was created because of a sinful relationship, a nation that has led God's people into sin and will continue to lead God's people into sin. But you notice something different about her because you show up to work the next day and there she is. She's wanting to glean from the field, but she doesn't show up like the other gleaners, the other orphans and the other widows and the other foreigners who are traveling through God's land, who are invited into the Hebrew welfare system where you get to work for your food and you're provided the opportunity to be able to feed yourself and to feed your family. She shows up in humility and she asks for the privilege of working there. And what are you going to say? No? And you watch her and she works hard all day. And then your boss, Boaz, happens to come in from town and he happens to stop by this portion of the field. And you notice his eyes kind of lock in on a certain portion of the field where she's working, and you tell Boaz all about her. And then over the coming weeks, you notice that he starts supervising that part of the field a little more frequently. And she used to be the honored gleaner, but now she's brought in and she's invited to be part of the family. And she's dining at the table during the work lunches with Boaz himself. And you start to think, wow, Boaz is a man of hesed. Look at Boaz showing covenantal love towards this foreigner. And his character reminds you of someone. And you can't quite place who it is that his character reminds you of as he goes beyond the letter of the law all the way to grace. But then one day something unusual happens. You're running back into town because you left something at home and you're supposed to be working all night because this is the last night of the harvest and there's a big party. So you ran home to get what you forgot, and you see Ruth is walking towards the threshing floor and it's starting to get dark and you think, well, this is kind of strange. And you notice her clothes are different. She's no longer wearing her clothes of mourning, her clothes where she's grieving her husband. She has changed her look. She's no longer in mourning. She's letting someone know that she's available. And you think, well, she's going to the threshing floor. This could be dangerous for her. But then you remember, Boaz is there. He's a righteous man. He's going to keep her safe. So you think nothing of it. And then the next day, morning's here, you've loaded up all the grain, you're taking it into the city, you're going through the city gates, and you notice there's a big crowd there. You notice that everybody's talking, there's a lot of commotion, and there's at least 10 elders of the city standing around. So you know it's a big deal. You know there's 10 elders anytime there needs to be some sort of legal decision or some sort of dispute settled. And you look, as you get closer, your boss, Boaz, the man of hesed, the man of faithful, loyal, covenant-making, covenant-keeping love, is standing right in the center, and he's looking towards another guy, and he's directing all of his attention towards this other guy, and everybody's in leaning in, trying to hear what's going on, and we're about to be invited to hear what's going on, and this reads a lot like a court transcript. Anybody like courtroom dramas? Yeah, my wife and I, we love watching courtroom dramas because we love seeing justice prevail. Because occasionally it does. So what we're going to do today is we're going to peer into this courtroom drama. So here's how we're going to outline the text for us this morning. And this is a tough outline. I scrapped everything for the sermon. I think it was Thursday, and started reworking everything in the sermon. So I never got to actually come up with a homiletical outline for you. This is just a textual outline. So it's going to be kind of rough. But as we look at this, I want you to keep sight of the main theme. The main theme is redemption because of love. And we're going to see it come out through this courtroom drama. So we're going to see Boaz's preparation for the court action in verses 1 through 2. We're going to see the report of the court proceedings in verses 4, 3 through 8. And then we're going to see Boaz's response to the outcome of the court proceedings in 9 through 10. And then we're going to see the public's reaction to the outcome of the court proceedings in 11 through 12. Sounds kind of dry, but it won't be, I promise you. So let's do it. Let's look at Boaz's preparation for the court action. So think of the Law and Order ding ding right now. We're peering into these court proceedings. And so look at verses 1 and 2. And let's see him prepare for this court action. And we're going to see that he's going to confront that closer kinsman redeemer we learned about last week. And we're going to see that he's a very astute man. He understands the law of God, and he's very shrewd in his understanding of God's law. He's going to display a lot of wisdom. So look at verse 1. Now Boaz had gone up to the gate, and he sat down there. And behold, the redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, "Turn aside, friend, and sit down here." And he turned aside, and he sat down. And he took, he is Boaz, and he took 10 men of the elders of the city, and he said, "Sit down here." So they sat down. Now, remember where we are. Naomi came up with this plan to get Boaz to warm up his cold feet because the relationship had not progressed, because Boaz thought he was too old for Ruth, and he knew that she was still in mourning for her husband, Mahlon, who had died. So they came up with a plan to let Boaz know that Ruth is available. And Ruth made sure that Boaz understood exactly what she was after. She made sure Boaz knew that she wasn't at the threshing room floor for a night of passion, but she was there for covenant. She was there for redemption because of love. And she wanted to see if Boaz loved her. And that's what we're waiting to find out now. And Boaz said, yes, I will take care of you, but there's a problem, right? Every love story, there's a problem. Anybody like love story movies? You know why I don't like them? I'm so thankful that my wife doesn't enjoy them, so I don't have to watch them all the time. But I've seen like three of them. They're always the same story. It's someone who's in a relationship. They're usually married, but it's not the person they're supposed to be married to. So they end up leaving the person they're engaged with or married to for the true love of their life. Isn't that how Hollywood usually goes? That's not the type of redemption we're talking about. We're talking about redemption because of covenant-making, covenant-keeping love. Love that doesn't depart, love that never leaves, love that loves through the good times, through the hard times, through the bad times, love that is present and available even when the emotions aren't where you want them to be. This is the kind of love we're talking about. So Boaz said, the problem in this love story is there's a closer redeemer. There's someone else who has a responsibility to take care of Naomi and to take care of Ruth. And he says, I'm going to take care of it. So Boaz goes into town and we see that he's a man of his word, because verse 1 lets us know right away, soon as even before the gates are open, before people go in the city, Boaz is there and he's waiting. That's a man of his word. He doesn't wait till 10 o'clock to kind of roll into town. He's up first thing in the morning. Let that be a lesson for us. As people of God, our word has to mean something. As Jesus said, our yeses should be yes, and our noes should be maybe, right? No, our noes should be no. Our word has to mean something. We have to keep our word even when it hurts. That's the type of man Boaz is. And if we're not a people who consistently keep our word, then the way the world is going to look at us, they're going to see that our faith that we're proclaiming is as worthless as our word. So we want to be people of the word and people who keep our word for the glory of our God. And that's who Boaz is. He's a man who keeps his word. And here's old Bo. He's sitting there and he's taking a load off at the city gates. And I love the text. Just look back at verse 1. It says, now Boaz had gone up to the gate and he sat down there. And I love this. It says, and behold, the Redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. And it's the idea of, behold, the guy that Boaz was talking about just happened to show up that day and just happened to be going through the city gates. It's a little bit of humor. The author keeps doing this with the book of Ruth. He wants to let you know that it's not chance, it's not happenstance, it's not circumstance that he showed up. This is God's providence. God has structured everything in the universe for this moment to take place. And so Boaz is sitting there, and he happens to show up, and I love what he says next, because the English really doesn't do justice to the Hebrew here, so I'm going to unpack it a little bit. So Boaz said, turn aside, friend, and sit down here. Turn aside, friend, and sit down here. But the issue is, that isn't exactly what he said in the Hebrew. He didn't really say, turn aside, friend. He said, turn aside, Poloni, Almoni in the Hebrew. And I want you to hear that in the Hebrew, Poloni, Almoni, because I want you to hear how the words rhyme, right? This is a Hebrew way of saying a certain somebody. So there's going to be a little bit of derision in the way the author calls this guy Poloni, Almoni, or as I like to say, Poloni, Alphoni, because we're going to see that this guy is a phony. This other redeemer is truly not a redeemer. So Poloni Almoni means a certain someone. It's kind of like a John Doe, or keep the rhyming intact, it's kind of like Mr. So-and-so. So the author says, Mr. So-and-so shows up, and he doesn't even give him a name. This is the only valuable character in the story that is not even given a name. And the reason why you'll see pretty soon he's not given a name is because the author wants you to question this man's character. He wants you to right off the bat to think of Mr. So-and-so, Mr. Poloni Almoni. So he's sitting there and he grabs Poloni Almoni, Poloni Alphoni, and then he gets 10 elders because this constitutes a legal forum. And I want you to see how shrewd Boaz is. Boaz knows who this guy is. He knows his name. He knows his name. He doesn't have to call him Poloni Almoni. He knows his name. He's a relative of Boaz. Right? They're related. This is a small town. You know everybody in a small town, right? And everybody knows your business, even the part of your business you don't want them to know. So he knows Poloni Almoni's business. He knows his character. He knows he's not a man of Hesed. We're in the period of judges. Everybody did what was right in their own eyes, except for Ruth, except for Boaz, except for Naomi. There's still faithful people, even in a period, even in a generation that is corrupt. But Ploni Almoni, he's corrupt. Now, Boaz could have gone to his house the night before, right? He knew where he lived. It's a small town. And he could have knocked on his door and said, hey, you know what? Tomorrow, I'm going to bring the elders of the city around. And this is the subject I want to talk about. We're going to talk about what to do with Naomi and Ruth. We're going to talk about how to redeem Naomi and how to redeem Ruth. So do your research, search the law of God, be ready and show up. But he doesn't do that. He brings him, or he waits for him to show up without any recognition of why he's there, because he wants to spring this on him. He doesn't want this guy to look for loopholes. He doesn't want this guy to research the law. He doesn't want this guy to come up with legal ways of doing what he wants to do. He wants to do not the letter of the law, but to go all the way to grace. So he doesn't tell the guy that he's showing. So now he's got the 10 men around, the 10 elders. So now we have a legal forum. So let's see what happens. Let's now look at the second thing. Let's look at the report of the court proceedings. Dun, dun, all right. Law and order? Okay. Chapter 4, verses 3 through 8. He's going to open up his negotiations. I guess this would be his opening statement. Verse 3, then he said to the Redeemer, Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. Now, this is new information. The first thing we heard about selling of land. So there's a lot of opinions on this, but I'm going to give you what I think fits the context the best. You're not allowed to sell the land. In other words, the land always stays within the family. But in the Hebrew law, what you can do is you can sell the right to use the land. So if I'm poor or I lose all my finances and I have God's land, what I can do, I can sell myself into slavery to someone and I can work for them until the debt's paid off. Or I could take my land, if I'm the elder in the family and I own the land, I can take it and I can sell you the right to use my land. And you get to make all the money off the land. Whatever harvest is harvested, whatever money is made, it's all yours. You get to treat the land like it's your own. I still own it, but you have the right to use it. So that's what's going on here. It's the right to sell the use of the land. Now, so if you fill in the picture, what had taken place when Elimelech left his land, when he left God's country, when he left God's people, he sold the right to use the land, which didn't really mean anything because there was a famine in the land, so they're not making any money off the land. Now, Naomi's coming back. She still owns the land as long as she's alive, but as soon as she dies, the land goes to another redeemer. It goes to a closer relative. In other words, she can't preserve the name of Elimelech and the family line and keep the land in that portion of the family because she's too old to have a child. And if she had sons, then it would stay in the family, but both of her sons have died. So as soon as she dies, Ruth is going to have to leave Israel. There's going to be no one to take care of her. So what she's doing is she's asked Boaz, and Boaz has come up with this plan, and Boaz is going, and he says, I'm asking you to do what Leviticus 25 talks about and be a kinsman redeemer, and I'm asking you to buy this land because it's been sold, the right to use the land's been sold to someone else. I'm asking you to step in, buy it back so that Naomi can now live off of the profits. So that's the idea. That's what's going on here. And we're going to have to make a couple judgments here. So here's Mr. Ploni Almoni, Mr. So-and-so. Do you think he knows that Naomi and Ruth are in town? Yeah, if you glance back to Ruth chapter 1, verse 19, it says the whole town was astir. The whole town was abuzz. The whole town was talking about the fact that Naomi's back. So he knows Naomi's back. He knows Elimelech is dead. He knows Mahlon and Chilion are dead. Here's what happens to the land if he does nothing. If he chooses not to act as a redeemer, if he chooses not to go seek out Naomi, if he chooses not to say, how can I help you? How can I buy back this land so that you can live off the profits? If he chooses to do that, guess what happens to the land? As soon as Naomi dies, it's his. All of it. Forever. Then his family can enjoy it. Then his kids can inherit it. So are you starting to see why the author doesn't give this man a name? Are you starting to see why the author calls him Ploni Almoni? Because he has questionable character. This is not a good man, and Boaz knows it. So he's worried about self-interest. So look back at verse 4. Watch how Boaz does this. Because the man's done nothing to redeem. Verse 4 says, here's Boaz. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, now he could have done this the night before the elders were there, but he didn't. He says, I thought I would tell you of it and say, by it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people, if you'll redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me that I may know, for there is no one beside you to redeem it, and I come after you. And watch what the man says. The man says, oh, well, I'll redeem it, right? See, if he redeems it now, as soon as Naomi dies, it's still his. So he's contemplating, I haven't done this yet because I'm just waiting for her to die, right? She's had a hard life. She's in poverty. If I don't do anything to help her, she's going to be gone in a couple of years anyway, and it's all mine. But now Boaz, he's kind of put this out in the open. All the other elders know this. So if I say I don't want to redeem, now Boaz gets the land. Well, I don't want that to happen. I want it for myself, and I want it for my family. Plus, how long can the lady live anyway? So I take care of her, I feed her for a couple of years, then I get it all. So he goes, yeah, okay, I'll redeem it. So he says that he'll take it. Now, watch what happens next, because Boaz is about to trigger a legal responsibility that the man isn't smart enough to know doesn't apply to him. This is so cool. Look at verse 5, then, because he doesn't know God's word. Verse 5, then Boaz said, the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite. So you get this foreign woman from the wrong side of the tracks, from a wrong people, a type of people who are despised. Oh yeah, you get her too. And then he continues, you get Ruth the Moabite, the widow of the dead, and that would be the Mahlon, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance. Now, this is cool. So what he's saying is the moment you redeem the land, guess what? You also get Ruth. Now you have to give Ruth a child. And if Ruth has a son, guess what? Mr. Ploni Almoni never gets the land. You know who gets the land? Naomi. Because that son carries on the name of Elimelech. So that land stays in that family line forever. This comes from Deuteronomy 25, 5 through 10. We've talked about this. Technically, Mr. Ploni Almoni, Mr. So-and-so is not required to do this. Boaz is not required to do this. The only person who's required to do this would be the brother of Mahlon, which is whom? Kilion. Where is he? He's dead also. So what is Boaz doing? He's saying in front of the elders who know the law that I'm a man willing to go beyond the letter of the law. I go to the spirit of the law. I go all the way to grace. He's putting God's covenantal love on display. He's showing everybody around what redemption because of love looks like. And most likely, Mr. So-and-so doesn't know that he's not legally required because Boaz didn't give him time to go out and search the law. He sprung this on him in the presence of everyone. And now he's shaming this man into making a decision right there on the spot. He's forcing this man to show his hand. He's putting a lot of pressure on him. See, when you walk through the city gates, the streets are very narrow. So there's not room to stop by and have these big conversations. So what they did is they built right at the gates these alcoves on both sides where there's these places to sit down so people can sit down and gather and can hear disputes like this. So there's enough room for minimum the 10 elders plus about 20, 30 other people in the city just to watch and see what's going on. So the crowds are there. They're gathering. They're listening to everything. So let's see what happens, because the suspense is building in the story. He already said he would buy the land. Is he going to redeem Ruth? Well, the author doesn't want us to leave us in suspense too long. Look at verse 6. Then the redeemer said, this is Mr. Ploni Almoni talking, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it. Mr. Ploni Almoni, Mr. Ploni Alfoni, has neither the character nor the motives to redeem anyone. He doesn't understand redemption because of love, because he doesn't understand hesed. He's never tasted God's love. He's never experienced God's love. He doesn't know what it's like to be redeemed when you're unredeemable. Therefore, he has no desire to sacrifice to redeem anyone. He's too busy worrying about his own inheritance. He's too busy worrying about his own finances. He's too busy worrying about his own name. He's too busy worrying about his own estate. He's not consumed by love. He's consumed by finances. And he sounds to me a lot like the rich young ruler, a man who wanted to know what redemption was about, a man who God cared for dearly. But when he came and spoke to Jesus, Jesus told him what he had to do because Jesus knew the idol that was in that man's heart. And the cost was too great. This redemption thing, it's too big. Being a disciple costs too much. I don't want to die to myself. I don't want to sacrifice. If you've tasted God's love, if you've been redeemed because of love, you know that the only way to love biblically is to sacrifice yourself. That's what biblical love is. Ploni Almoni is not willing to sacrifice himself for love. But Boaz is. Contrast those two characters. You got Mr. So-and-so. He's a man who's not ruled by love. He's ruled by the ledger. You have Boaz, a man who is ruled by love. And he's willing to sacrifice himself for that love. So-and-so, not willing to pay the cost. Boaz steps in. Look at verses 7 through 8. Now, this was the custom in the former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm a transaction, the one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other. Man, I'm so thankful I'm born in this generation and not that generation. I just don't like feet, don't like shoes, dirty sandals, don't want to be part of it. Think about all the animal and the feces and the dirt that they're walking through. Okay, sorry, you guys still want to have lunch today. So they drew off his sandal and they gave it to the other, and this was the manner of a testing in Israel. So when the Redeemer said to Boaz, buy it for yourself, he drew off his sandal. He refused to restore the name of Naomi and of Elimelech. Therefore, he didn't receive a name. Anonymity of this man implies judgment of this man. He tried to save his name. He tried to fight for his name. And what did he eternally lose? He lost his name. Boaz is willing to sacrifice anything. What did he get? A real name. He got a legacy out of it. So let's see how Boaz responds to the outcome of this court proceeding. We're going to see this in verses 9 through 10 as the assembly's there. Boaz is going to go into full detail what his intentions are towards Ruth. Look at verse 9. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people. Remember, the crowds are there. They're in the alcoves. They're listening. They're watching. You are witnesses this day that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and all that belonged to Mahlon. And he doesn't stop there. Look at verse 10. Also, Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife to perpetuate the name of the dead, that's Elimelech, in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native place. You are my witnesses this day. This is Boaz legally obligating himself. So because the 10 elders are there, if there were only 9 there, he wouldn't be legally obligated. Although, because he's a man of Hesed, he would legally obligate himself. But he's legally obligated now in front of everyone. This is an official court proceeding now. That he is redeeming Ruth. That he is redeeming Naomi. And that he is carrying on the family line of Elimelech at great sacrifice to himself. This is a man who knows God rightly. Therefore, he worships God intimately. And this causes him to live differently. And you can see it because he loves radically. This is a man changed by love. This is a man bought by love. This is a man conformed to the image of what love is. Man, he looks a lot like someone else. So the family resemblance in Boaz, it's just uncanny. Can't quite put my finger on who he reminds me of. Ephesians 5:25. Christ loved the church. He gave himself up for his church. Isn't the family resemblance just uncanny? That's why Charles Spurgeon calls Jesus our glorious Boaz. Christ came all the way from heaven, and he did it, and he gave himself up for his bride. He shed his blood because he loved his bride, his church. The bride of Christ. That's you. That's me. That's us. He redeemed us because of love, just like Boaz redeemed Ruth because of love. Now, I want you to see the last thing I want you to see today is I want you to see how the public reacted to the outcome of this court proceeding. Because there's something beautiful that happens when you see love on display, when you see a love that mirrors the love of God, that points to the love of God, it causes everybody, when they see the character of God on display, causes people to celebrate. Watch what happens. Well, everybody except Ploni Almoni, I imagine. But everybody else was celebrating. Look at verse 11. Let's see the public's reaction. So everyone's witnessed this, and they're going to give a threefold blessing. Look at verse 11. Then all the people who were at the gate and the elders, so all the people and the 10 elders said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house," that's Ruth, "when they make that woman that's coming into your house like Rachel and like Leah, who together built up the house of Israel." So what they're praying for is that Ruth can have a baby. Now, this is important because Ruth lived with her husband, Mahlon, for 10 years in Moab, and they never had a baby. 10 years is the mark of when you're considered to be barren. So they're praying that this barren woman, through Boaz, a man who is on the upper age, right? He's an older man. He's not a young man. Remember how he praised the love of Ruth for not going after a young man because that would better her chances of having children and your sons can take care of you when you're in your elder age. That's the idea. So he's an older man. So they're praying for not the character of a child. They're praying for straight up fertility. That's what they're praying for. See, Rachel and Leah, their offspring are what? The 12 tribes of Israel. So they're praying for Ruth to have a legacy. They're praying for Ruth to have a child and for this child's legacy to be dramatic, to have no end. That's the first part. Let's look at the second part of the blessing, which just kind of builds on it. It's a poetic parallelism that's going on. So it takes the first blessing and extends it. Look at verse 11 as I continue reading. "May you act worthily in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem." So through this child that they're going to have, may your name be known. May you have a great name. May you be famous. May you be prosperous through your offspring. Huh, I wonder if that prayer was answered. And the third thing that they're praying for, if you look at verse 12, you'll see that they add, "And may your house be like the house of Perez from Tamar bore to Judah, because the offspring that the Lord will give you by this young woman." Now, this is kind of cool how you're going to see the history of redemption played out by them talking about Tamar and talking about Perez. Perez was not the family line through the line of Judah that you would think would become the greatest family in all of Judah. But that's exactly what happened. You see, the family of Perez was the preeminent family in all of Judah, right? It was the most noblest family. It was the most powerful family. It was the family everybody looked at and said, "I want to be like that family." That's what they're asking for Boaz. Perez, the biggest family in the line of Judah. Boaz is in the line of Judah. May he become the preeminent family in the line of Judah. I wonder if that happened. I wonder if there was someone from the lineage of Judah. I wonder if there was ever a lion of the tribe of Judah. I wonder. Sunday school answer, there was. His name's Jesus. Okay. But he not only compares Boaz to Perez, he compares Ruth to Perez's mother, Tamar. Now, she was a foreigner, just like Ruth. She was a foreigner, just like Ruth, who lost her husband. Her husband was one of the sons of Judah. So what should have happened is one of Judah's boys should have said, "I will give you a child so that that child can carry on the name of your dead husband." But Judah forbid it. He said, "I'm not going to allow that to take place." So she did something very unrighteous. She posed as a prostitute. And here comes Judah coming out of town, and there she solicits him. Judah sleeps with her. She gets pregnant. She had taken something from him so she could prove that this child belonged to Judah, and therefore her family line was carried out. That's the line of Perez, and it became the preeminent line. So she did something unrighteous and got the preeminent name in the tribe of Judah. Ruth only did what was righteous. Who had the greater name in the tribe of Judah? She did. But you see the comparisons, and you see how God blessed righteousness here. So those are the three blessings that we see. So let's kind of wrap this up. Here's Mr. So-and-so, anxious to preserve his estate, anxious to preserve his name, lost it all. We don't know his name, but we know Boaz's name. We know Ruth's name. We know their offspring's name. We know the most famous offspring, King David. No, not only King David. We can go further, King Jesus. So if you want a name, if you want a legacy, sacrifice. Die to yourself. This is the economy of God. You want to be great? Make yourself a slave. Become a servant to everybody around you. You want true power? Humble yourself. Sacrifice for others. The first will be last in God's kingdom, but the last will be first. So what do you think happened next? I don't know, we got to use our imagination a little bit here, but I imagine as soon as that prayer ended, Boaz grabbed those sandals and ran about as fast as an old man can run all the way to Naomi's house where Ruth is still living because she doesn't have a husband. And I bet there was a knock on the door. And you know, Naomi and Ruth are in there. You know they didn't sleep all night. Do you think you would sleep all night? Am I going to get redeemed by this guy I don't even know whose character was questionable? This Mr. Almoni, this Poloni Almoni, Alphoni, this guy? Is that who's going to redeem me? He's a hard man. He's not a good man. He's not a loving man. What's going to happen? Is Boaz going to be able to purchase our redemption? Is this going to happen? You know they were up all night. They opened the door. There's Boaz. I know what I would have done. I would have been like, trying to pretend like it didn't go well just so I could surprise. I drive my wife and kids crazy. I do that all the time and they throw stuff at me. I'm abused. It's really bad. I throw stuff at me all the time. But I doubt Boaz did that because he has more character than I do. I could just see him. Ruth opens the door. Boaz is standing there. He can't contain the smile on his face. He reaches behind his back and he grabs those sandals and he holds them and he says these words. I redeemed you because I love you. Those words she's been waiting her whole life to hear. Family, if you know Jesus, if you love Jesus, if you've repented of your sin and put your faith in the one true living God, Jesus Christ, I want you to believe this. He redeemed you because he loved you. I want you to hear him saying those words to you. You are redeemed because Jesus Christ loves you. There is no redeemer that you will ever meet who loves you more than Jesus. There's zero redeemers. Out of all the little R redeemers that are out there, there is no redeemer who wants you more than Jesus Christ wants you. I hope you believe that. There is no little R redeemer out there who will do more for you than your capital R redeemer, Jesus Christ, has done for you on the cross and is doing now for you as he sits at the right hand of his Father interceding for you on your behalf because he loves you. If you know him, if you love him, if you serve him, if you treasure him, if you cherish him, let that thrill you. Let that kindle the affections of your heart until it overflows into an outpouring of love and let it come out into your proclamation of who Jesus is and what Jesus has done on your behalf and never, ever, ever, never stop telling people about how great your God's love is. Amen? If you don't know him, if you're sitting here and you're thinking about the song of those from that hymn, the lyrics from that hymn, I need no other argument, I need no other plea, it's enough to know that Jesus died and that he died for me, and you can get every line out but that last line, that he died for me. I haven't felt that, I haven't experienced that. Why do you think you're here today? Why? Because your parents drug you along? Because a friend grabbed a hold of you and said, I'm not leaving you alone today. I'm making you come with me to church. That's not why you're here today. It's because of God's providence that you're here today. And he has you here today because he wants you to know who your true Redeemer is. It's not that spouse you dream of having one day. It's not your current spouse. It's not your children. Your true Redeemer is Jesus Christ. And he loves you. And he's asking you to turn from the way you're living, to turn from your sin, to ask for his forgiveness, and you will be cleansed of all unrighteousness, and you will be forgiven, and you will be able to call his Father your Father. That is gospel good news. That is redemption because of love. That is great news. Let's pray.